Do you swear on the Constitution of the United States to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
This is Police Radio,
the voice of American law enforcement,
with your host, Randy Sutton.
Hello and welcome to Police Radio, the voice of American law enforcement. I am your host, Randy Sutton. Each week, we talk about all things policing. And we have special guests that have interesting points of view and some very special features like Police Story, where we feature the story of an active duty or former police officer from a time in his career. But before we begin, I would like to give you the Randy Sutton view from the blue. It's a time to come together. The division that exists within our nation is eroding the very fabric of our country and its people. The dividing line is a very brilliant color, blue. Law enforcement has become the symbol of the chasm that separates vast segments of our society, and it is tearing us apart on levels that I have never witnessed. But the American law enforcement officer isn't the cause, only the whipping boy in a country that has yet to come to terms with our racial legacies and the responsibilities that fall upon us individually and collectively as a nation. I've spent my entire adult life as a police officer, for 10 years in a small, wealthy, and educated town in New Jersey, Princeton, and almost 24 years in a city far away from that insulated and educated community, Las Vegas. They could not have been more different, and yet, it was during the more than three decades of policing that I witnessed the most miraculous of changes. But before I can talk about those changes, I must describe the incubator from which I viewed them. My window to the world was from behind a badge from the time I was 19. Witnessing the human condition from a center stage seat in the theater of life can get a bit messy. Performing CPR on your friend and mentor on the dirty locker room floor of the police station after he suffered a heart attack during a hurricane leaves the indelible taste of vomit in your mouth forever. Watching a man burn to death as you helplessly try and extricate him from his car while engulfed in flames leaves a permanent image that scars your soul. But that's just part of the job. You're expected to live with those images and the hundreds, thousands of others that compound them. Images of cruelty and desperation, of pain and loneliness, moral corruption and incomprehensible sadness, violence that leaves the coppery taste of blood on your lips. While you bear these images in your soul, you're expected to maintain a cheery attitude, treat people with respect and dignity, withstand the insults hurled at you from citizens incensed that you would have the audacity to write them a ticket, and don't overreact when someone spits in your face or punches you while they try to escape. Those are the realities of every cop that has more than a few years on the job. They don't share them, not with their wives or husbands, and not even with those who shared the horrors alongside them. Because to share them is to admit those realities and the clutch that they have upon your heart. Now we laugh at the funny stories instead and have another drink as we toast the retirement of a colleague who survived the career and is headed off to a new life, even as we secretly dread that day for ourselves. Because on that day, we're no longer part of something that we know is desperately important to our community and to our nation. When I first became a cop, I was 19. Except for one other police officer, the age range between me and the next guy was about 10 years. I was a kid walking into a world I knew nothing of. I lived with my parents, and both my mom and dad were World War II veterans who had experienced more of life than I realized at the time. But one thing they instilled upon me was that all people are equal in the eyes of God and the law. That skin color or religion was of no consequence when determining the worth of a person. I believed it then and I believe it now. But during the early years of my police career, the word nigger was thrown about easily. I was shocked at first, but when the word is used so frequently, it becomes almost part of the landscape, not even noticeable, and that's the danger. Now when I hear that word, I find it revolting, but I never hear it from those I served with or anyone in my social circle. I only hear it in music videos or rap songs or comedians. And everyone who is saying it is black. And that's the amazing metamorphosis of which I speak. I haven't heard a police officer use that word in almost 20 years. It's not because of rules and regulations or fear of departmental discipline. It's because the thinking, the very thought processes that give rise to a racist point of view has evolved and in many cases been eliminated. Now this is something to be celebrated, but in the most incongruous of circumstances, the American law enforcement officer is finding themselves being accused of racism on a scale I've never seen before. I've fought my whole life against injustice. That's why I and the majority of those who serve took up the badge in the first place. To fight for those who need a protector. To be willing to be the buffer between the honest citizen who merely wants to raise their children in a safe environment and those who would do them harm. You see, when it gets down to it, cops become cops for the very old-fashioned reason that they have chosen to serve and protect. They don't care about color or creed or religion, and if they do, they'll find out very soon that they chose the wrong career. America is more divided than I have ever seen. Unfortunately, this division served the purposes of some in the political system and some who have made a living preying on the fears of others. But not the people of this nation. It's time for people of every race and nationality, every religion and orientation, who believe that America is one nation, under God and indivisible, to stand up for our beliefs and our heritage. It's time to put aside the petty quarrels and understand that as a nation, one nation, we can build a community that respects our similarities and our differences. And works together for the common good, and believes that the only race worth mentioning is the human race. And that's my view from the blue. I want to take a moment to tell you about Nevada Safe Company. It is the largest safe warehouse company in Southwest United States. They have got the largest selection of safes, both for guns, for security reasons, and they are located right here in Las Vegas at 5250 West Charleston. Nevada Safe Company. Go to NevadaSafes.com. I personally know the owner of this safe company. His name is Captain James Dillon. He's a retired law enforcement officer, and he is really proud of what he's created here. It is something to behold. He's got 800 safes in his inventory right now, Liberty and all kinds of other brands. If you are looking for a safe, and if you own weapons, you should be. Check out NevadaSafes.com and give Captain James Dillon a call at 702-331-7233. Today in the interview room, I have a very special guest. It's a man who is one of the most trusted names in news and commentary in the United States. He's touched the lives of many people with his insight and wisdom. And some people love him, some people hate him, but you'll never forget him. His name is Mr. Bill O'Reilly, and he has been a Fox commentator for many years. And during my interview with Bill, he was kind enough to tell me about a subject that I'm always interested in, and that is personal heroes. And that is the topic of our conversation. Sit back and enjoy the interview room with my guest, Mr. Bill O'Reilly.
Hey, Lieutenant Bill O'Reilly, how are you?
Thank you so much for calling me. Please call me Randy, and I'm very honored to be speaking with you, and I thank you so much for taking the time for me today.
Sure, no problem.
Well, I think you might know the basics behind the book. It's about personal heroism. Not so much in the physical sense, but in the sense that the heroism that personal heroes have for people that do significant things for others. And
right.
I've got some amazing people in the book. I think you're acquainted with a couple of them, including Father Joe Carroll, and you might know Bob Dole too. He gave me a nice story.
Sure.
So I would like to know for you to tell me
the achievements in your life of which you are most proud, professionally, personally, and spiritually?
Well, the spiritual, I'm not going to get into because I think that's a personal deal. I will say that, you know, my family history is Roman Catholic from the very beginning of civilization. And my people came to Ireland early, and I try to respect that tradition. Personal, you know, again, it's hard to talk about myself in the capacity of being a hero. I don't see myself that way. I have a code that I adhere to very strictly, and that is, if I say I'm going to do something, I do it. So if I say, let's have lunch, we'll have lunch. If I say, I'll call you back, I always call you back.
Right.
Or my assistant does, or, you know, there is contact made. I take what I say seriously, so I don't mislead anyone ever. That's my code, no misleading. On a professional level, you know, I have a lot of achievements. I've been fortunate over the 35 years in journalism, and even before that, teaching high school. You know, to be able to do my job responsibly, and then you get opportunities to rise if you're in that situation, as you know, Lieutenant, being in the military. You always, things come along where you get an opportunity to prove yourself. I think I did that when I covered the war in El Salvador and the Falkland Islands War in Argentina. I think I proved myself there that I was willing to do what it takes to get the story, even if it included, you know, going into a zone that was dangerous. I'm proud of that because you never really know how you're going to react in those situations.
Sure.
I always gave my employer my best shot, and I earned my money. I didn't take my money. I earned my money, my salary. So I always made money for people in our capitalistic system. That's what you do. So I respected that process. I didn't fluff off or, you know, phone it in or anything like that. I always tried my hardest and tried to earn my money. And I think I largely succeeded in doing that, even when I was a younger man. On the other fronts, you know, I've achieved what I wanted to achieve through perseverance and hard work, not necessarily talent. I wasn't the most talented guy on the block, not the best student in school, but I worked very, very hard. That work ethic was given to me by my parents, and then I, you know, when they knocked me down, I got up, and you keep getting up, and pretty soon they're not going to knock you down again. And that's what happened to me.
I hear you. Thank you. Who is the person or the persons that most inspired you to become the person that you are? And what were the traits or characteristics of that man or woman that you admired the most and that affected you to become the person that you are?
I don't think there's one individual. You know, I was on my own fairly early in life. I left my house at 17 to go to school, and that was pretty much it. I mean, I came back for summers and worked and everything, but I didn't have a familial attachment after 17 years old. So my parents were there, and the structure was there, but I was doing things. I was out of the house. So there wasn't that, and you know, I never really idolized anybody as an adult, and when I was a kid, it was all sports people, Willie Mays and Joe Namath and people like that. So there really is the one person that I said, look, I want to model my life on this person. I just, over the years, evolved into a person who admired certain things. The paramount one was not hurting anyone, not misleading anyone, whereby your words or actions would hurt them because you catch them by surprise. I didn't do that because I saw a lot of people get hurt when they were caught unaware by other people's deceit. And I said, you know what, it isn't worth it.
Mm-hmm.
So the short-term pain of telling the truth in difficult situations overrides, you know, the deceit that may really hurt another person. I guess that might be, you know, something that Jesus espoused. But I'm not a holy roller. I'm not, you know, even though I wrote Killing Jesus, I'm not a guy who is basing his life on spirituality. So it was more of a mosaic for me. It was more of a, you know, I looked around, I saw certain people accomplish things, and they did, and I liked the way they did it, if they did it honestly, if they worked their way up. And then as I got older and met people, then I kind of said, you know, this is the person I want to be.
Right. I see what you're saying. You know, I know that you have been very involved in charitable organizations, and you've done a lot personally in charities. Is there someone that that kind of mentored you at one point or another in your life? For instance, when I was a policeman in Princeton, there was a sergeant that I worked for that one day really taught me what the meaning of compassion was, and it was a lesson that I took with me for the rest of my police career. Is there someone, or was there an incident in your life that you really remember that was an aha moment as far as you really gaining a valuable lesson from someone?
I think that the generosity of spirit and of means came from my mother, who was very selfless. I mean, while all the other mothers in the neighborhood would kind of ration how they would drive kids to the movies or sporting events, or, you know, they were counting, well, I did it four times and now it's your turn. My mother would never do that. She would always volunteer. We didn't have a lot of money, but, you know, it was always about other people rather than about us. There wasn't any narcissism in my house. And so growing up, my mother's generous spirit, I think my sister is a nurse, and I'm almost positive she got that from my mother.
Mm-hmm.
And then mine was, you know what, if you have something and you get more than you're expecting, then you should give some of it away. I mean, I always had that. And I think that came from my mother.
Right. Can you tell me something about the charities that you're involved with?
Well, we do a lot of children's charities. You know, I believe that many, many children on this earth are being punished by stupid adults. And, you know, fathers who leave the home, mothers who are addicted, poverty that's crushing, and the parents can or won't figure a way out of it. And the child isn't responsible for any of that. So we try to zero in on charities that work very, very closely with children. That's number one. We get a whole bunch of them. And then the military people who get hurt. I don't think the VA is a very well-run organization.
Right.
So we've stepped into that breach. Specifically, though, not generally, very specifically. So there's track chairs, you know, for the guys who lost limbs and the blind. I mean, the VA wasn't going to buy them, and, you know, so we bought them. We got $20 million together to get them. So I like to see, you know, my charity directed very specifically to certain things that I see happening myself. I don't kick big money into the big organizations. I think they have enough, and they've got their machine rolling. They don't need me. I'm more of a niche. We give a lot of money to a San Diego charity called Responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy, basically, he is keeping Mexican children in Tijuana pretty much alive. And, you know, he's like a modern-day Dr. Tom Dooley, this guy, Lynch. And so, I went there, and I did a story on him, and I saw it. So we've been supporting him for 25 years.
That's fantastic. You know, when you think of the term personal legacy, do you believe that your personal legacy will be remembered? How would you choose to have your personal legacy remembered?
Well, give a lot of thought to that. I mean, when I die, I don't expect to get fair treatment by the press. I mean, you know, I don't ever expect to be treated fairly by them. I think the folks who see me every day after 18 years know who I am. So they'll be sad, and they'll remember. People will remember. Even if I retire tomorrow, they'll remember. So I'm not real worried about that. I do what I can do, and I've written my books. I think those books will be there for the ages, and they'll be read long after I'm gone. So that's a good legacy to have right there. But otherwise, you know, when I'm gone, I'm gone. I'm hoping, you know, if there's an afterlife, I hope they have a shot at, you know, a good position there. You never know.
Well, you know, the personal legacy is something that I'm very concerned with, and that's what this book, which is the first in a series, is really all about: people being cognizant of what their personal legacies will be, and then hopefully choosing to be personal heroes themselves in great or small ways, which is, you know, the whole purpose behind this book. And you're in very good company. The people that contributed stories, for instance, Frank Shankwitz, whose name you might know, but whose deeds you do. He's the one that created the Make-A-Wish Foundation.
Yeah.
And there's just some really amazing giving people that really don't get their due. So they're getting the opportunities to tell me their personal heroes, the stories of their personal heroes, and hopefully pass that legacy on through the reader. And I agree with you entirely that the written word is, I believe, the most powerful medium that there is. And so that's why this book is so important. I can't thank you enough for taking the time to speak.
Sure, good luck with it. And when it comes out, I mean, give us a heads up. Send me a galley, and I'll give you, you know, a little publicity on the show. But I'm very interested to read it. So, Andy, I appreciate you including me.
Thank you so much. I hope you got a copy of the book that I sent you, A Cop's Life.
Yes, it's right on my chair over here with the four others, but I'll get to it.
Okay. Thanks so much, and I hope someday to have a cup of coffee with you.
Each week on Police Radio, I read a story that was written by a law enforcement officer in this country. It's called Police Story, and this segment is dedicated to all the men and women who all have a story. Some of these stories are funny, some of them are sad, but they all portray the reality of law enforcement. And this week, the story is called Little Johnny on the Front Porch by a Hobbs Police Department officer named Clint McCain. I had been on patrol on my own for about 2 years. I was in the phase of my career where I wasn't a rookie anymore, and I thought I already knew just about everything there was to know about law enforcement. I had gotten past the initial shock of seeing my first dead person, homicide victim, child abuse case, and so on. I had made it through all of these situations, and I thought I was pretty hard. I had survived my first fist fight, high-speed pursuit, drug raid, and ass chewing from my lieutenant. You hear stories of how police officers lose sleep and have to seek counseling due to the trauma and stress of the job. I had made it through all of this and never felt depression, anger, or sleeplessness. You had to be hard to be a police officer, and the guys who experienced those things were just not cut out for the job. This was my considered opinion after my first 2 years. My perception of the job, and maybe more importantly, my perception of myself was about to change. It was a nice summer evening in August, and I was working the swing shift, 2 to 10 p.m. It had been uneventful, and I was heading home for my lunch break. A call from the dispatcher came over the radio of a female down, unconscious and not breathing. I was only about 2 blocks from the address. All I could think of was, damn it, I'm going to miss my lunch break again. It was probably some elderly lady who had passed away, and I was going to catch another report, be stuck on scene all night waiting for the coroner to show up. It was my job, though, and I knew this, and this is what I signed up for, so I responded. I beat the paramedics to the scene by several minutes. For a cop, this is not always ideal. Sometimes you roll up into a situation that you're not capable of handling because you did not have the medical expertise needed. You carry a gun, not a trauma kit. Applying pressure to a bleeding wound or starting CPR is just about all you're trained to do as a police officer. When I rolled up on this scene, it was different. The only thing I saw was a little boy. We'll call him Johnny. Johnny was sitting on the front porch with his face in his hands. Johnny was 9 years old and looked to be your typical little boy, dirty blue jeans and sweaty hair, a bicycle sitting next to him. I assumed that Johnny's grandfather or grandmother had passed away. As an inexperienced cop, you seem to jump to conclusions and think you have it figured out even before you even have the facts. In your mind, you think you know everything because you made it past your rookie years. All Johnny could tell me was that it was all his fault, over and over again. Johnny kept saying it was his fault. I knew I shouldn't have left her and went outside to ride my bike. I wasn't real sure what I had on my hands at this point and asked Johnny where she was. Johnny, still crying and without lifting his head, pointed to the front door of the house. In the master bedroom, I found a 30-year-old woman hanging lifeless from the ceiling fan with a rope around her neck. It was apparent that she was dead. I returned to Johnny on the front porch. He was still sitting and crying in his hands. I wanted to comfort him, but I needed to find out if this was suicide or homicide or if the woman was even his mother. I placed my hand on Johnny's back and I asked him what had happened. His mother's boyfriend called on the telephone and broke up with her, Johnny said. His mother was very upset and he just wanted to get out of the house, so he went outside to ride his bicycle for a while until his mom calmed down. I'll never forget Johnny's anger at himself as he shouted at me. I knew I shouldn't have left her alone. I should have stayed with her. She was crying. I'd never been so speechless in my entire life. I knew there was nothing that I could say or do that would provide comfort or relief to Johnny at this point. As a police officer, you always think you have the answers and will be able to provide help to a child in time of need, but I had nothing in my arsenal to help Johnny with his pain. Johnny was blaming himself for the selfishness and death of his mother. I'm not one to preach, but for a mother to kill herself and leave that sight and responsibility for her son to live and deal with is unconscionable. Once the dust had settled and things were winding down, I began to feel something I had never felt up to this point in my career. I felt totally helpless. What could I do? What could I say? And the hard, terrible answer was nothing. I could only watch. I'll never forget Johnny sitting in the back seat of the detective's unmarked cruiser. No family could be located for the boy, and the only thing we had was a counselor from the state. And the counselor was trying to help Johnny, but his face was turned away from her with the deepest, blankest stare I had ever seen. I'll never forget his face with the mud created from the tears running down his dirty little cheeks. On the inside, I was crying. But I had to be hard around my peers. In some ways, I've never stopped crying for Johnny on the inside. I've never forgotten that I'm not a god, that I don't have all the answers. In this one night on the job, I learned more about life and myself than I had in the previous 2 years of my career, or probably any of the years that followed. Throughout my career in law enforcement, I was involved in homicide investigations, narcotics investigations, high-speed chases, two officer-involved shootings, but none of it had the impact on my heart as the night that I found little Johnny sitting on the porch with his tear-soaked face in his hands, blaming his own self for his mother's senseless death. All of the training had not prepared me for this. I remember sitting in those critical incident stress classes they give you in the academy thinking, this is ridiculous. Why don't they just teach us what we need and let us out on the street? Now I was thinking maybe I should have paid a little more attention. I lost sleep for the first time since becoming a cop. I started to wonder whether I was just one of those soft guys who wasn't cut out for the job. Surely that wasn't possible. This reaction must be normal. Just go home, have a few beers, it'll all go away. Now I know that this is why cops struggle with alcoholism at an alarming rate. Too often we can't admit that something bothered us and got us down, made us helpless. We don't want to be looked upon as soft by the other officers, and it's so hard to admit that something is eating away at your mind and your heart and your soul. So we drown those feelings in a bottle. I was no different. I had to take a hard look at myself and my career. I had to face the fact that being tough and capable meant doing my level best, facing my fears and uncertainties. Honestly, it was a tough process and scary too. None of the emotions I was feeling, though, would ever compare to what little Johnny would endure for the rest of his life. I often think of him, where he is and what has happened to him. I'll have Johnny sitting on the porch with his face in his hands, engraved in my memory forever. That story was taken from True Blue to Protect and Serve, a book that I put together several years ago. And that story is symbolic of many of the stories in this book. It's available on Amazon.com and also on my website, RandyLSutton.com. If you like that story, if you have your own story and you think that you would like me to read your story, and you are a active duty or former or retired law enforcement officer, send it to me. Send it to me at my email, RandySutton@AmericaOutloud.com. This is End of Watch, where each week we honor the men and women of law enforcement who have sacrificed their lives in the line of duty during the previous week. Right now, there have been 30 police officers and law enforcement officers who have given their lives in the line of duty since January 1st. 16 of those have been murdered in the line of duty. The rest have been accidents and other causes. We've seen an increase of approximately 150% in the shooting deaths of law enforcement officers so far this year. This is a very difficult time for law enforcement. In addition to those 30 police officers who've given their lives, 10 police canines have also died in the line of duty. And we need to honor them as well. On March 26th, police officer Susan Louise Farrell of the Des Moines Police Department, Iowa, died in the line of duty during an automobile accident on March 26th. On March 26th, another Des Moines police officer was killed in the same incident. Police officer Carlos Puente Morales of the Des Moines Police Department. On March 26th, Trooper Jeffrey Nichols of the Texas Department of Public Safety, Texas Highway Patrol, was killed in an automobile accident. And on March 31st, it was the end of watch for Trooper Chad Dermeyer of the Virginia State Police, who was murdered in the line of duty by gunfire. A moment of silence, and we honor those lives. This is End of Watch. Welcome back to Police Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, with your host Randy Sutton on the America Out Loud Network. Let's take a walk to the briefing room where we talked about all things current events, news, and everything about policing. There was a police officer murdered in the line of duty. It happened March 18th in Greenville, South Carolina. His name was Alan Jacobs. And the circumstances of his death, of his murder, was that he had spotted a suspect who he was very familiar with. He was a known gang member. In fact, this officer had put him in prison. He was a young man, just in his late teens. And he had been sentenced to 10 years for a robbery. And he served a grand total of 251 days of that 10-year sentence and was out. Officer Jacobs and another police officer saw him and went to talk to him, referenced an investigation, and the suspect took off. He ran. Officer Jacobs went into foot pursuit, and when he turned a corner, the suspect was waiting for him with a semi-automatic handgun. He opened fire on the officer, and he murdered him. He then turned the gun on himself and killed himself, but not before taking the life of a man with a wife and a family, a man who proudly served his community for years. Now, why do I bring up this murder on this show? And it's because there are some situation about this that really needs to be discussed. And that is that police officers around this country are hesitating to use deadly force. They're hesitating for a number of reasons. And many of these reasons are because of the political fallout that they believe might happen as a result of using deadly force. Other reasons are that police departments and agencies are changing the rules. They're changing the use of force policies. And that's what happened in this case. So I want to talk about that because I think that this is very possibly an event that we are seeing take place in various police agencies around the country. So now, keep in mind that this officer was killed March 18th. On March 14th, the police chief of this small community went public with a new use of force policy. Okay? He went out publicly to tout this new use of force policy, and the headline was that the Greenville police chief changes use of force policy in wake of national outcry. Now, why is that important? Because what this headline says is that the police chief looked at what is happening around the country, saw the fallout from deadly force incidents in Ferguson and many other places, and decided to create a use of force policy that is 18 pages long. That's right, 18 pages long. And I watched the television interview he gave about this new use of force policy. And what I saw frightened me. Because in essence, it sounds to me as if he put this use of force policy, which is very, very complicated to understand, into effect because of the political atmosphere, not because it would make the streets safer for his police officers in the community. In essence, what he said was during this interview was that the only time it is justifiable for a police officer to use deadly force is when he is facing a deadly threat. Now, it's simply not true. It's not simply when an officer is facing a deadly threat against themselves. It is also when they are facing a deadly threat against someone else. Now, why the chief didn't mention that, I don't know. But then there's other circumstances when a police officer is justifiable to use deadly force. For instance, if they can articulate that a subject is a threat to the life of other people when they are fleeing, then they are also justified in using deadly force. So, in essence, what this police chief said was incorrect. And in his explanation, it sounded more of an appeasement than it did as trying to create a policy to increase the safety of law enforcement officers and also the public. Now, let me mention this now. When Officer Jacobs was in foot pursuit of this suspect, at the time that he was shot, his weapon was still in the holster. Now that means that he never drew his weapon. And he had knowledge about this man's violent past. Whether he had suspected that there was a weapon involved, I don't know. But the fact of the matter is that in the use of force policy, it addresses even taking your weapon out of the holster. It's part of the policy. and they consider that even removing your weapon from the holster is considered a use of force. So 4 days after this 18-page massive policy change took place, this police officer was killed in the line of duty. We will never know what the thought process was during those final seconds of this officer's life. But one thing is for sure, that police officers around this country are hesitating to use deadly force, and it has deadly consequences. For a police agency to create a use of force policy that is so lengthy and convoluted, this places officers at risk. Police administrations need to keep this in mind, because there is one common thread that I hear from police officers from all over this country. And I have communications with cops from the biggest cities to the smallest towns. You know what they tell me? They're more afraid of their administrations than they are of the bad guys on the street. This is a dangerous situation for our law enforcement officers. This is something that can only be addressed from police leadership. And we're not seeing a great deal from police leadership these days. They seem to be fragmented. They're not on the same page when it comes to their policies and procedures. There's 18,000 different police departments in this country. 18,000. And police leadership on a national level needs to step up to the plate and create meaningful policies, policies that have in mind the safety of their officers. I want to thank you for tuning in to Police Radio, the voice of American law enforcement. I hope you enjoyed this segment, and I look forward to your feedback. Please, my email is randysutton@americaoutloud.com. I look forward to your comments, to your suggestions. If there's a guest that you would like me to have on this show, please feel free to send me that information. If you have written a story and you are an active duty, retired, or former law enforcement officer, and you want to submit that story, send it to me at the same email, randysutton@americaoutloud. For any of my books, the one that you heard today on this show was True Blue to Protect and Serve, full of stories from cops from all over the country, or my book, A Cop's Life, all stories from my own career, or stories of personal heroes, which is The Power of Legacy, personal heroes of America's most inspiring people. Go to Amazon.com, and if you would like me to personalize any of those books, please feel free to contact me and we can make that arrangement. Once again, thank you so much for listening to Police Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, with your host, Randy Sutton.